from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from London.
40 years ago, we've just learned, without telling ministers, Britain supplied plutonium for Israel's nuclear program. And this has just come out at the moment that Britain is lining up with the United States to try and report Iran to the Security Council for their own civil nuclear program.
Secret papers reveal the British government helped Israel build the atom bomb. The secret plutonium and uranium shipments were made behind the backs of British ministers, including then-Technology Minister Tony Benn. We'll speak with Benn, one of Britain's most distinguished politicians and the longest-serving MP in the history of the Labour Party. Then, the next Gulf, London, Washington, and oil conflict in Nigeria.
The international media is currently full of issues about the chaos and violence in the southern Nigeria and the Delta area, and we've been exploring the corporate and the geopolitical strategies that make this violence come about.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Dubai-based firm DP World has announced it will not take control of operations at six U.S. ports following a firestorm of criticism. Instead, the company said it would transfer the management of the ports to an unnamed U.S. entity. It remains unclear whether DP World plans to sell off its U.S. assets or set up a U.S.-based subsidiary to run the ports. Congress had threatened to derail the handover of port operations to DP World, claiming national security would be endangered if a company run by the United Arab Emirates operated the ports. But President Bush vowed to veto any legislation put forward by Congress to block DP World from taking over port operations. The Washington Post reports one company that might take over for DP World is the Carlyle Group. Halliburton also has been mentioned as a possible buyer. Meanwhile, a similar controversy is brewing over another business merger. An Israeli-based company called Checkpoint is in the process of buying the high-tech firm Sourcefire, whose technology is used to protect some of the government's most sensitive computer systems at the Pentagon and the National Security Agency. The Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States has launched an investigation into the proposed sale. The FBI reportedly opposes the sale of Sourcefire to any foreign firm because the agency fears that would give away the keys to the government's most sensitive computer networks. More than 250 medical experts have co-signed a letter condemning the United States for force-feeding prisoners on hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The letter appears in the British medical journal The Lancet. The doctors wrote, quote, "We urge the U.S. government to ensure that detainees are assessed by independent physicians and that techniques such as force-feeding and restraint chairs are abandoned." The doctors also said the American Medical Association should instigate disciplinary proceedings against any members known to have violated ethical codes while working at Guantanamo. Meanwhile, the Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez, has been in London this week promoting what is going on at Guantanamo, defending the practices there. Two civil liberties groups asked the federal courts on Thursday to force the Bush administration to end its warrantless domestic spying program because it violates the privacy and free speech rights of U.S. citizens. The requests from the Center for Constitutional Rights and the American Civil Liberties Union came just days after Republicans blocked a Senate investigation into the National Security Agency spy program. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero said, quote, "In America, no one is above the law, not even the president. The president's allies in Congress are preparing to cover up his illegal program while others in Congress are standing on the sidelines. When the president breaks the law, Congress should not be giving him a get-out-of-jail-free card," Romero said. Meanwhile, a former high national security lawyer at the Justice Department has come forward to criticize some of the Bush administration's key legal justifications for the warrantless spying program. Former Associate Deputy Attorney General David Criss says the Bush administration's contention that Congress had authorized the NSA program by approving the use of force against al-Qaeda was a, quote, "weak justification and likely to be supported by the courts." Chris oversaw national security issues at the Justice Department from 2000 until 2003. In news from Iraq, the Iraqi government hanged 13 people accused of being insurgents. It marked the first execution of militants since the U.S.-led invasion. The name of only one of those executed was released. In Baghdad, another journalist has died. Munsif Abdallah Al-Khaldi, a television presenter with Baghdad TV, was shot dead by unidentified gunmen while he was driving. Meanwhile, the Pentagon is now denying reports that it's preparing to soon close the notorious Abu Ghraib prison. On Thursday, it was widely reported the Pentagon planned to close the prison within the next 3 months and transfer the 4,500 detainees to another prison. But defense officials are now saying there's no specific timetable for closing the prison. One of the top stories this morning on the Pentagon's own website, Defense Link, reads, quote, U.S. has no immediate plans to close Abu Ghraib prison. Defense officials are saying that the U.S. always has planned to transfer authority of the prison to the Iraqis, but announcements regarding the imminent closure at the Abu Ghraib prison are premature. In other Iraq news, a federal jury has found the military contractor Custer Battles guilty of defrauding the United States for grossly inflating the cost of projects in Iraq. The lawsuit was brought under the Federal False Claims Act, which allows company whistleblowers to bring suit on behalf of the government and to share in damages awarded. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld appeared before the Senate Appropriations Committee on Thursday, seeking $65 billion more for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was pressed repeatedly about how the U.S. would deal with a civil war in Iraq. Rumsfeld said the plan is to, quote, have the Iraqi security forces deal with it to the extent they're able to. Meanwhile, a protester was thrown out of the Senate hearing after disrupting testimony by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice.
Illegal and immoral war.
Please,
how many of you have children in this illegal and immoral war?
The committee
will come to order. The blood is on your hands, and you cannot wash it away. The blood is on your hands, and you cannot wash it away.
During that same hearing, Rice issued yet another warning about Iran.
We may face no greater challenge from a single country than from Iran, whose policies are directed at developing a Middle East that would be 180 degrees different than the Middle East that we would like to see develop. This is a country that is determined, it seems, to develop a nuclear weapon in defiance of the international community, that is determined that they should not get one. It is a country that is the central banker for terrorism, whether that terrorism is in southern Iraq or in the Palestinian territories or in Lebanon.
That was Condoleezza Rice, U.S. Secretary of State. Here in Britain, the police killing of an innocent Brazilian man who was mistaken to be a suicide bomber is back in the news this week. On Thursday, Prime Minister Tony Blair discussed the killing of Jean-Charles de Meneses shortly after a meeting with Brazilian President Luiz Inácio de Lula da Silva.
Once again, let me say that we offer our deepest regrets to the family for this very tragic event. And I, of course, assured the president that the proper investigations and procedures would continue through to their conclusion.
But the family of Meneses said they would, quote, never accept Blair's apology. Meneses' cousin, Alex Pereira, said, quote, I won't accept Blair's apology because he's killing people. He apologized, but at the same time, they will still carry on their shoot-to-kill policy. And in California, a woman is suing her former employer after she was fired for having a bumper sticker for the progressive radio network Air America. The woman, Linda LaRocca, alleges in her lawsuit that her boss at Advantage Sales and Marketing fired her on the spot after seeing the bumper sticker and then said, quote, the country is on a high state of alert. For all I know, you could be Al-Qaeda, the employer said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This is our last day of the week of broadcasting from London. And you can go to our website for all of this week's broadcasts. BBC News revealed on Thursday The British government secretly supplied Israel with hundreds of chemical shipments in the 1960s, despite fears the chemicals could be used to develop nuclear weapons. Analysts say the shipments, which included plutonium, helped speed up Israel's acquisition of the atom bomb. All told, the BBC reported the British chemicals could have been used to produce bombs 20 times as powerful as those dropped on Hiroshima. The deals were made in violation of strict government policy, according to declassified government documents. A British government official named Michael Michaels oversaw the shipments behind the backs of his superiors. One of these superiors is our guest today. Tony Benn was Britain's Minister of Technology at the time in the 1960s. That post was one of many that have come in the career of one of Britain's most distinguished politicians. Tony Benn served in the British Parliament for over half a century. He's the longest-serving MP in the history of the Labour Party, which he joined in 1942. In May 2001, Tony Benn retired from the House of Commons to, in his words, devote more time to politics. While many politicians take on corporate or lobby positions when they leave office, Benn became one of the harshest and most vocal critics of the Iraq War, a prominent leader of the Stop the War coalition in Britain. In February 2003, 1 month before the invasion of Iraq, Benn interviewed Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. In December of last year, Tony Benn was the lead signatory to an appeal sent on behalf of dozens of prominent British political and cultural figures asking the UN to investigate the U.S. and British governments for war crimes in Iraq. He's the author of a number of books, including Free Radical, New Century Essays, and Dare to be Daniel, Then and Now, an autobiography. We welcome Tony Benn to the studios here in London, to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Well, let's begin with why you're in the news this week in Britain, and that has to do with, well, we'll talk about Iran in a minute, but right now, this expose on, well, some 40 years ago, Britain helping Israel develop the atomic bomb secretly.
This came out of the availability of papers that had previously been secret. I knew Michael Michaels very well. I went through my diary, which is about 17 million words long, and picked up every reference to him. And I had good grounds for not trusting him. But I had no idea of this, of course, at all. And he was doing it behind the back of ministers, and it undoubtedly did assist Israel and was intended to assist Israel, because I believe after he retired, he was given a job by the Israeli government. So there can be little doubt that that was what it was about. But if you look at the story of nuclear weapons and nuclear power, it's very interesting. When I remember as a Navy pilot hearing about Hiroshima, and I visited it later, and Nagasaki, then Eisenhower said, "Atoms for peace." And that moved me. I thought a classic case of swords into plowshares, if you remember the Bible. And I became an advocate of civil nuclear power. I was told it was cheap, safe, and peaceful. And having been responsible for it for many, many years, I learned from experience it wasn't cheap if the cost of storage of nuclear waste and the research. It isn't safe because Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and Windscale and so on. And it wasn't peaceful. That all the time it was motivated by the desire to build nuclear weapons. And, I mean, the example we're just discussing was one. But I discovered after I left office that without telling me, the plutonium from our civil power stations, what we called Atoms for Peace power stations, all the time is going to the United States for its weapons program. So I've learned a lot from this. I'm now a passionate opponent of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, always was against nuclear weapons. But this story highlights the hypocrisy that lies behind so much of the comment about the non-proliferation treaty.
In the BBC Newsnight story that we watched last night, that's big headlines today, one of the people interviewed is a man named Peter Kelly, who was at Whitehall, who was a defense intelligence analyst, who said he recognized quickly back then in the 1960s when shown pictures of what the Israeli government was saying was a textile factory. This was Dimona. He said this is a nuclear factory.
Well, of course, Mordecai Vanunu, who was arrested by, he was kidnapped in London by the Israelis. He was telling the Sunday Times what was going on. imprisoned, much of it in solitary confinement, recently released with restrictions, but he warned us about Dimona. And I did know later about Dimona as an Israeli military establishment, but I never knew until yesterday, or until it came out a few days ago, that we had helped to assist the Israelis in building it.
And you, as technology minister, would have had to sign off on this if you had known. Is this right?
Well, it wasn't put to me at all. It wasn't put to ministers. I mean, this is the trouble with the nuclear industry. I came not to believe what I was told. And that throws a doubt on more than nuclear power, the question of democracy. If officials can operate as a state within a state, where is the democratic control of policy? So it was a very, very serious thing to happen. And, of course, it also comes up at a time when, as you've been pointing out, there's a lot of pressure now on Iran not to develop nuclear technology in any form.
We're going to go to Iran in just a minute, because I want to play you some clips of politicians in the United States, like Donald Rumsfeld, like the New York Senator Hillary Clinton, about Iran. But before that, do you think Harold Wilson, the prime minister at the time you were technology minister, signed off on this, knew about what Britain was doing?
I've no reason to believe he did. I would find it very hard to believe he had known, but I can't be absolutely sure. He was very sympathetic to Israel, I knew that. But he was so strong on non-proliferation. And you see, in another case later, when we discovered Pakistan was developing the bomb, I took it straight to a cabinet committee on non-proliferation to see if we could take action to prevent it. So there's no question of that government being weak on proliferation question. So I have no reason to believe he knew.
Mm-hmm. I also heard Mordechai Vanunu interviewed on the BBC responding to this expose in Britain. And he said, I continue to call for international inspections, or rather independent inspections of the Dimona nuclear plant.
Well, you see, the United States and Britain are in total breach of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty says three things. One, the nuclear powers will agree to disarm collectively. Secondly, that other countries can develop nuclear technology. And thirdly, that nuclear powers will give absolute assurances they will never use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states. And both the United States and Britain have now said that if their security was at stake, they would use nuclear weapons. What Bush has done, I don't think he realized it, that make the case for the spread of nuclear weapons. Because I tell you this, if Iran had nuclear weapons now, he would not dare to attack it. So actually, Bush is encouraging the spread. And when he went to India the other day, which isn't a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, he signed an agreement. So, I mean, the thing is total hypocrisy. I think if we get that clear, then we can consider how we deal with the situation that faces us.
Technology that could be used for nuclear weapons to India?
Oh, well, India is a nuclear weapon state. It isn't a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Bush's technical agreement will obviously assess the whole thing.
Let me play you some of the U.S. politicians talking about Iran. I wanted to talk about the Bush administration stepping up its rhetoric against Iran. This is Vice President Dick Cheney addressing the annual gathering of the American Public Affairs Committee on Tuesday.
The Iranian regime needs to know that if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose meaningful consequences. For our part, the United States is keeping all options on the table in addressing the irresponsible conduct of the regime.
That was Vice President Dick Cheney speaking on Tuesday. That same day, the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was asked about Iran at a Pentagon news conference. And this is what he had to say.
I will say this about Iran. They are currently putting people into Iraq to do things that are harmful to the future of Iraq. And we know it. And it is something that they, I think, will look back on as having been an error in judgment.
Talk of military force against Iran has not been exclusively Republican. This is Democratic Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton of New York speaking at Princeton University in January.
We must move as quickly as feasible for sanctions in the United Nations, and we cannot take any option off the table in sending a clear message to the current leadership of Iran that they will not be permitted to acquire nuclear weapons.
New York Democratic Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. We're going to go to break, and I'll get your response to what the U.S. and Britain are saying about Iran and what you think should happen. We're talking to a longtime politician here in Britain, Tony Benn. Stay with us.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan. But the oil men in the White House, they just don't give a damn. 'Cause it's all about the price.
Bragg, the price of oil. And we're going to be talking more about the price of oil in our last segment of the broadcast as we look at what's happening in the Niger Delta. But right now, we're talking to longtime activist and member of parliament, Tony Benn. He left parliament 5 years ago, the longest running member of parliament in the history of the Labour Party. And now your title is President of
the Stop the War Coalition and a lot of other things as well.
And I like your tie, by the way. And for our radio listeners, he is wearing a tie with a peace sign on it.
That's right.
Tony Benn, you know Billy Bragg, the musician?
Very well,
we just
indeed,
played?
Yes. I've known him for years and years, and I appear with him from time to time. He makes speeches and sings songs. I'm a great admirer.
Who makes the speeches and who sings?
Well, I make the speeches usually, and he sings.
Well, I want to talk about Iran with you. We just played the quotes of Donald Rumsfeld saying they're currently putting people in Iraq to do things that are harmful to the future of Iraq, talking about Iran. Dick Cheney, who said the Iranian regime needs to know that if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose meaningful consequences. Hillary Clinton, we must move as quickly as feasible for sanctions, UN. Your response?
Well, a lot of responses. First of all, I was energy minister in 1976, 30 years ago, and I had 3 hours with the Shah in Iran. The Shah, as you know, had been put there by the CIA. They got rid of Mossadegh, the very courageous Iranian leader, and they put the Shah on the throne. And when I was there, the Americans were pushing me to give nuclear technology to the Shah. And indeed, President Gerald Ford, with Cheney as one of his very junior officials, and I rather think Wolfowitz involved as well, was trying to get Iran to adopt nuclear power.
Wait, talk specifically. Say again, the U.S. was trying to get you as
energy
minister.
Well, no, the U.S. itself. I mean, there's no doubt the U.S. was involved as well. But I was also involved because they were trying to persuade me. And I was a bit nervous about it because I knew the link between nuclear technology. Second thing to say is that those three statements would justify Iran going to the Security Council and making a complaint that those three statements constituted a threat to them and a threat to world peace. Now, of course, with the veto, you never get it through. But that is something that, if it were the other way around, supposing Iranian ministers had made that statement, Bush would have made a preemptive strike. And you see, language is so important. And I think that it's totally hypocritical, particularly as Britain and America are building new nuclear weapons and are defying the non-proliferation treaty themselves. I think, actually, Iran could go to the International Atomic Energy Authority and complain that the United States was in breach of the non-proliferation treaty.
We just broadcast last week from New Mexico, of course, the home of Los Alamos and the building of the atomic bomb. And Britain and the U.S. just participated in another, well, I don't know if it was supposed to be secret, but it certainly wasn't test at the Nevada test site.
Well, all along the line, I mean, Blair says he wants a new generation of civil nuclear weapons, which nuclear power stations, which is what Iran wants. And also he wants to upgrade the Trident missile, which is out of date. So while Blair and Bush are planning nuclear power and nuclear weapons, which is in breach of the treaty, they're then accusing Iran of being in breach of the treaty, which they're not. Nobody has suggested Iran is in breach of the non-proliferation treaty. What the IAEA says is that they should be more transparent. So this is being whipped up exactly as in Iraq.
Now, the president of Iran has said he will make the U.S. feel pain if the U.S. does the same to Iran. Do you find that threatening?
Well, if you're about to be attacked, and the three statements you've made indicate that a military attack may be on the cards, and there are far more explicit statements than that from the Israelis and from others, if you're under attack or threatened attack, I suppose it's reasonable to say if you attack me, there'll be consequences. I don't think I'm defending Ahmadinejad, who's made some statements that have been very unhelpful. But this is all being built up. Do you remember when Colin Powell went to the Security Council and said he had pictures of mobile biological laboratories? A complete lie. And it's a terrible thing to say, but I no longer feel under any obligation to believe what my own prime minister says. I've disagreed with prime ministers in the past, but I do not feel we are told the truth, and I don't think the president tells the truth, and we are being moved into a situation rather like Iraq, where you remember they went to the UN Security Council, couldn't get support, so they attacked anyway. And if I were the Iranians, I would be very concerned. I broadcast to Iran about once a week, and I say to them exactly what I'm saying to you. And I think there is a danger. I don't think the United States plans to invade Iran, but to bomb it. And when they complain that Iran is involved in Iraq, well, who really is involved in Iraq? The United States and Britain occupied the country, and then they say Iran is providing some support for the Shias. I mean, it is an extraordinary story. And most people in Britain, I think, understand that. And even in the United States, the president's popularity seems to be very low. So there must be a lot of people in the United States who understand this as well.
We were talking to a New York Iranian professor about what happens to the pro-democracy movement in Iran when the U.S. intensifies a campaign against Iran. And they said the pro-democracy movement there is the first to suffer because they're very critical of the regime. But in times of heightened tension, the regime sees them as allied with the West, with their critics outside.
Well, that's an exact parallel with what's happening in the United States. I mean, the United States, under attack following 9/11, is giving up its civil liberties. So if you threaten Iran, such civil liberties as they have will be given up, and those who advocate more democracy will also be locked up as agents of the United States. I do think language is so important. I mean, take Guantanamo Bay, for example. We never say about Guantanamo Bay the truth, which is that America has kidnapped these people and is holding them as hostages. We say it when the Iraqis seize people, but there's been a kidnapping of all these people by the United States, and they're held outside international law. We don't say that. So I think language, this is why Democracy Now!, my favorite program, is so important, because you bring to people's attention facts that are indisputable but throw a different light upon the situation.
I wanted to ask you about the crackdown on civil liberties here at home. It's interesting. We spent this morning, it was very cold outside, but we went over to Parliament Square, right across from the Parliament,
where
Brian Hall is. I think he's very famous here, perhaps not as well known in the United States, but a man who stood outside the Parliament for more than 4 years now, probably right around the time you left Parliament.
Oh,
he's taken up
long before,
an encampment there. He's the only one in Britain who is allowed to stand there. Yesterday on Democracy Now! We had Milan Rai, who has been arrested because he was too close to Parliament as he read off the names with another protester standing without a permit. of British soldiers who have died, Milan Rai, and also Iraqis who have died in the Iraq War, and he will be tried next week. What about the crackdown?
Well, it's very interesting because Brian Hoare is a very principled man. He's been there, and his revolutionary slogans say things like, don't kill children, love thy neighbour as thyself from the Bible. But this so worried the government that they introduced an Act of Parliament with the incredible title, the Serious Crime and Disorder Act. So it is now a serious crime and disorder to say, love thy neighbour as thyself, within yards of Parliament. Then when they took him to court, the judges said, ah, half a minute, he's been doing this before the Act came into force. So the only man who can commit the serious crime and disorder is the man it was intended to deal with, and they try to apply it to others. Mind you, the police are a bit worried about it, because I went and read the names of soldiers killed and Iraqis killed in Parliament Square, and I said to the police, be very careful, and they didn't do anything about it. So it's a bit flexible. They don't go for people who are well known, but it is the most restrictive policy on public protest.
What about the discussion of a national ID? National identity.
Well, a national identity card, you see, I've had identity cards when I was a pilot in the Air Force. I had a picture and my address and an office, and the same in other. The real problem is the database. Every bit they can pick up about you will be put on a database, and under the arrangements we have with the United States lends us nuclear weapons, we don't have our own, but in return demand access to all our intelligence. So all the information on my identity card, which may or may not be true, on the database will be available in the United States. And it is a police state. I mean, let's use plain language about it. When you can't move or do anything without an identity card, and that identity card links to a database, and the database contains lots of information. I'll give you one example. You may have heard of him. There was an old man of 83 who said nonsense at the Labour conference last year. He was interrogated by the police under the Prevention of Terrorism.
Who said what?
He said nonsense. All he did was to shout during the Foreign Secretary's speech the single word nonsense. He was thrown out of the conference and interrogated under the Prevention of Terrorism Act, and that will be on his database forever.
Parliament, the place where you resided for many decades, is also debating the whole issue of so-called extraordinary rendition, what others call kidnapping. Can you talk about this with the latest revelations of perhaps more than a dozen CIA flights going through British airfields?
Well, what is clearly known is that the United States has found it convenient to send people they suspected of some terrorist activity to countries where torture occurs, and to ship them there by aircraft. Now, since the United States is a long way away from Jordan or Algeria or Egypt or wherever it is, they've been landing at British airports. And since torture is absolutely banned by international law and by our own domestic law, it is a scandal that the British government allowed this to happen. They denied it was happening. And some countries in Europe raised it. And now they've had to admit that some of these flights have occurred. But you see, this is a problem for Bush and Blair. How can you talk about maintaining your values when you hold people without trial, don't allow them access to lawyers, shift people across the world to be tortured? I mean, it completely invalidates the argument that this so-called war on terror is a war between people on the one hand who absolute disregard for human rights and people on the other side, ourselves, who are absolutely above reproach. And I think the impact of the rendition flights in Guantanamo Bay and all the other policies has gone back to Iraq and quite properly has infuriated those Iraqis who want to American and British troops to withdraw. So it's making the situation worse and totally undermines the idea this is a crusade for high moral standards against brutality. There's no truth in that at all. I regret to say, but I'm afraid there is no truth in that argument we hear from the White House and Number 10 Downing Street.
We're flying out of Britain today. It has been a remarkable week. And last night we spent with Mozambique.
Yes.
At the Institute for Contemporary Art, he was speaking out. His book has just come out. He is synonymous with Guantanamo,
yep. Yes.
Though was tortured also at Bagram.
Yes.
And as we went back home last night to the hotel, we turned on Channel 4, the network here in Britain, to watch The Road to Guantanamo about the Tipton Three, the three young men who were held at Guantanamo for years, a devastating documentary. Can you talk about Guantanamo and Tony Blair and the British people?
Well, Guantanamo, of course, is part of Cuba and was held by the United States after the Spanish-American War. And because it's in Cuba, first of all, Castro has no control of it. And Castro is being criticized for civil rights breaches. But the greatest civil rights breaches in the island of Cuba is in Guantanamo Bay, controlled by the Americans. Then the president says that there is no jurisdiction in Guantanamo because it's not on American territory. So he gets it both ways. And, of course, what happens there is torture. And Mozambique was held. He's written this brilliant book in which, what interestingly about it, he gives credit to those of his captors who were nice to him, who were good to him. There's not a bitterness about it, although grounds for being bitter. And the torture there, the forcible feeding, there's now evidence that this is, well, we've known that's been going on for a long time. And British citizens or British residents are being held in Guantanamo Bay, and all the Prime Minister says, it's an anomaly. I was very pleased that Kofi Annan, whom I saw again, I've known him for some time, saw him in London the other day, very, very pleased he came out about Guantanamo. The Archbishop of York, the second most senior bishop in the Church of England in the Episcopal Communion, he's come out against it. And I think the United States is totally isolated. And you see, the funny thing about this, looking back at my life, because I was born in an empire, 20% of the population of the world was governed from London. And we locked people up. I met Mr. Gandhi, he was locked up. I met Nehru, he was locked up. Mandela was locked up. Kwame Nkrumah was locked up. And then they all ended up having tea with the Queen as head of Commonwealth countries. And I suppose you could argue, though it might be unacceptable to your audience, George Washington was a terrorist. He raised an army against the King of England, who was a legitimate king of the colonies. And so the whole thing is completely fraudulent. It is nothing to do with morality. It is to do with power. And when Bush said the United States was addicted to oil, which I've been saying for years, but he said it, addicts have a way of killing to get what they need. And I think the important thing for us now is to understand what's happening.
Alberto Gonzalez has also been here this week.
Yes, I heard him.
Campaigning on behalf of the practices at Guantanamo.
Yes, I heard
said
him.
You can interpret torture in different ways. What's your interpretation?
Well, I thought it was an amazing thing that since Britain is supposed to be the closest ally to the United States, that on their Hearts and Minds campaigns, they had to come and persuade the British people that torture was okay. And, you know, once you apply this argument, you see, supposing that Saddam Hussein had been criticized for the brutalities of which he was guilty, and he could have done a broadcast just like Gonzalez. He said, well, we're under attack. We've got people trying to undermine us. How regrettable it is, I have to put them in Abu Ghraib prison. I'm sorry about it. And you see, these arguments, there's a parallel that is never drawn. And although sometimes people feel powerless, if you understand what's happening, you're very powerful, which is why the United States now is launching a big attack on Google and the internet, because they realize that under Fox News and CNN, information is spreading now. People are understanding it. And on March the 18th, there's this big demonstration in London. It's going on simultaneously in 40 countries. Do you remember 3 years ago, the New York Times said there are two superpowers in the world, the United States of America and the World Peace Movement. We are a superpower. And in the end, the pen is mightier than the sword.
the mind is mightier than the bomb. So we have to be optimistic. We mustn't allow all this to depress us.
What makes you optimistic? Why don't you get depressed? I mean, here you are, head of the Stop the War campaign.
Yes.
You've served in Parliament for many years trying to stop war and torture, and yet look at the state of the world today. By the way, Abu Ghraib, I don't know if the U.S. is going to be closing it. There was the big news here in Britain last night that Abu Ghraib prison was closing, and now the Pentagon is saying it might not be true. But symbol of torture under the U.S., symbol of torture under Saddam Hussein, but built by British contractors.
Well, I know, but let me put this to you, because I'm 81 in a week or two. I mentioned I met Mr. Gandhi in 31. He was locked up.
Where was he locked up?
I met him in London. He came to London. I sat on the floor. I was six, and he sat next to me. And
your father was a member
My father was the Secretary of State for India at the time, and he brought him over. India became free. My mother was born in 1897. Women didn't have the vote. And then they did. I spoke in Trafalgar Square, a big centre in London, in support of a very well-known terrorist in 1964, and I was denounced in the tabloids. Next time I met him, he had a Nobel Peace Prize. He was president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela. And if you look at history, I mean, how did the environmental movement become important? How did the Third World movement become? Because people went on working at it. I have 10 grandchildren, and I think about them because my grandchildren, that generation, have got a choice to make that no one in history has ever had to make. For the first time in human history, the human race has the capacity to destroy itself with chemical, biological, and nuclear weapon. But also for the first time in human history, we have the technology and the knowledge to solve the problems of the human race. And a fraction of the cost of the war in Iraq would have given everyone in Africa with AIDS free drugs. That is the choice. And, you know, if you like, my interest in politics is intensified, and I don't want anything now. Old age has certain disadvantages, but A, you have experience, and B, you don't want anything for yourself. I'm absolutely free of any hint of ambition, not that I ever had much, and that is what keeps me going, and that's what keeps everybody going. So don't allow your viewers who follow everything you say because you're brilliant at it. Don't let them read into the bad news the idea that nothing can be done.
Your son is Secretary of State for International Development.
Yes, indeed, yes, for International Development. He's just been in New York this week with Kofi Annan trying to build up a permanent fund for droughts so they don't have to go around collecting money. He's a lovely lad. And my dad was a cabinet minister, three generations of cabinet ministers, five members of my family in four generations in Parliament in three centuries. I'm afraid we're all very committed.
As head of now Stop the War campaign, going back to Iran, you talk about how the U.S. and Britain are perhaps scapegoating Iran.
Yeah.
But you are fiercely opposed to nuclear proliferation.
Yes, I am.
Do you think that Iran has nuclear weapons ambitions?
Well, I don't know about that. All I know is that if you want a nuclear-free Middle East, which I do, then Israel will have to make all its installations open to inspection. And indeed, if that happened, I think the Iranians would probably say the same. But you have also to recognize even Iran, with its massive oil reserves, will have to think of the day when oil finishes. And there are people advocating civil nuclear technology. I don't myself, but I can understand it, because after all, that's what the president himself said in the United States. He said we've got to think of alternative sources of energy, and I think conservation and benign sources are probably better. But you could see the case for civil nuclear power, even though I don't share it. I understand it.
You even teach about the issue of religion and politics.
Yes.
I think Tony Blair just recently invoked talk about that.
Well, I was brought up by my mother on the Bible, and she told me something that I've never forgotten. She said the stories in the Bible, the stories, are about the conflict between the kings who have power and the prophets who preach righteousness. And she taught me to support the prophets and not the kings. It's got me into a lot of trouble in my life. But if I look at the great founders of religion, Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, they were teachers. They taught us how to live. And then people come along and try and use religion to get power. If you don't do what I tell you, you'll rot in hell. If you don't do this, you're hostile to the Quran or the Bible. And I think the abuse of religion, because for most people, including myself now, my religion is part of my culture. I think Jesus was a prophet. I think what he taught was good, and I think that in my society I'm used to Episcopalian churches and Catholic churches and the odd synagogue and now a few mosques. It's part of my culture. And to try and turn it into grounds for war, when Bush said it was a crusade, what a foolish thing to say. Because maybe they didn't teach him about the crusades in Texas, but by God, in the Middle East, everybody knows what the crusades were. We went there. There were seven crusades over 175 years. We sent armies into Palestine to recapture Jerusalem for the Christians. And the bitterness was enormous. And, of course, we lost all the crusades as well. So I see great dangers in the abuse of religious power. But I am myself a follower of the teachings of religious leaders. I mean, Moses said, don't worship the golden calf. I took that to be a direct criticism of the Dow Jones Industrial Average as the criteria by which you judge human happiness. You see what I mean? Or what's happened to the stock market. So they all have said something, but the abuse of it is so dangerous because this is not a war about religion. It's about oil and power. And if you understand that, then all the religious language disappears and you can go back to following the culture of your faith. And I respect people of all faiths, and I would expect them to respect my faith as well.
Perhaps one thing that has changed more than most other things has been the power of the media. What role do you see it playing now as the sword or the shield?
Well, I'm an old broadcaster myself. My first job was in the BBC as a producer in the North American service in 1949. And I think the media have replaced religion. Because in the old days in Britain, you see, Henry VIII had a row with the Pope about one of his weddings. I can't remember. He married six times. So he nationalised the Church of England. The Church of England is a nationalised institution. The bishops are appointed by the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister in Britain could be a Muslim or a Jew or an atheist. He would still appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury. So what the King recognised was that you had to have the Church as a media on his side. So you went to church and the bishop would say, God wants you to do what the King wants you to do. And now, with all the multinational corporations, Rupert Murdoch and all that, they're in effect saying, you must do what the President tells you to do. And in the interest of commercial interests as well. And so what we need is a free media. That's why I'm so interested in the democracy movement. I think of you as the Martin Luther of the media, somebody who is able to hammer something with a hammer on the church in Reims, I think, or whatever it was, proclaiming the right to think for ourselves. If we think for ourselves, we're safe. But if we allow religion, if you allow the mullahs or the rabbis or the bishops to control what you think, or if you allow Rupert Murdoch to control what you think, then truthfully we become slaves in a society which we ought to control because it belongs to us. Thomas Paine said, God didn't make rich or poor. He made men and women, and he gave the earth to be their inheritance. And he also said, my country is the world. My religion is to do good. You can't do better than that.
Tony Benn, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We have interviewed you for so many years on the telephone or when you came to the United States.
Yes.
It's very nice to come here on your soil.
Good luck.
Tony Benn, longtime member of Parliament, is the longest serving member of Parliament in the Labour Party, now the head of the Stop the War Coalition. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We are broadcasting from London, England. Stay with us. Peter King, Adjo, Nigeria, Afrobeat, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are broadcasting from London for our last day, and you can see our week of coverage from Britain on our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Nigeria. In recent months, the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, MEND, has intensified its conflict with the Nigerian government and its largest commercial partner, the oil giant Shell. Government forces have bombarded villages and oil rigs in its attacks on MEND's ethnic Ijaw rebels. Several unarmed civilians have been reported killed in the attacks. Meanwhile, MEND has kidnapped foreign workers, killed Nigerian troops, and attacked major oil installations. Their incursions have led to a 20% decline in Nigeria's overall oil production. MEND is demanding the release of imprisoned political leaders, an end to government corruption, a greater share of oil revenues, compensation for environmental damage caused by Shell's activities in the Niger Delta. Last month, a Nigerian court ordered Shell to pay $1.5 billion in environmental damages. But the oil giant refused to pay the fine and is now appealing the ruling. Rebels have also made similar demands of oil conglomerate ExxonMobil. Last week, MEND released six kidnapped foreign oil workers, three other hostages, two Americans and a British citizen remain in captivity. One of the freed workers, U.S. citizen Macon Hawkins, was released on his 69th birthday. Hawkins said, quote, "I think the U.S. needs to keep up the pressure on the Nigerian government to pay attention to these people and do something about their poor conditions," he said. The rebels' complaints of government corruption were bolstered Wednesday with the announcement the top military commander in the Niger Delta has been removed for his alleged involvement in the theft of crude oil. Rebel groups have long accused Brigadier General Elias Zamani and other top military officials of being key actors in the $100 million stolen oil trade. Analysts say the market for stolen oil is one of the leading issues at the heart of the region's conflicts. Despite the country's oil wealth, most of Nigeria's citizens live in abject poverty. Nigeria is the world's eighth largest oil supplier, fifth largest supplier of crude oil to the United States. President Bush has said he wants to see oil exports from the region increase. The Nigerian government recently asked Britain and the U.S. for military help in its fight against the rebels. Well, today we're going to take a look at the situation in the Niger Delta and how the British and the U.S. governments have become involved in its fate. We're joined by James Marriott. He is co-author of the book, The Next Gulf: London, Washington, and Oil Conflict in Nigeria. He's a part of the group Platform, which is a social and ecological justice organization based here in London. Welcome to Democracy Now! Hi. It's great to have you with us. Talk about what we're seeing right now in the Niger Delta.
One of the things that I think is very striking is the exactitude of the rebels' actions. If just today there's a news release of rebel action that's been stopped, has ceased to carry forward. In the eastern Niger Delta, there's most of this stuff that we've seen in the recent period has been in the western Niger Delta near Warri. The most recent stuff that's been happening is in the eastern Nigerian Delta. And there, the rebels have ceased holding kidnaps and restraint on an Exxon terminal called Kwa Ibo. And one of the things that's most interesting about it is that their demand, they had a clear, specific demand to Exxon that they should pay compensation for an oil spill that was made in 1998. So here they were making an action which was for compensation to be paid for something which was 8 years ago. A lot of the media representation of the rebels and so on and so forth in the West, in London and Washington, tends to be of people, you know, crazed kids with AK-47s running around. But actually, if you look at the detail of the thing, you realize just how exact their actions are. And you can see that they're demanding very specific things. What you mentioned before about $1.5 billion claim for oil compensation against Shell, the Senate, it was passed through the Senate, the Nigerian Senate, that this should take place. Shell said, as they have in many, many other cases, well, we're going to appeal against this, we want something to do. The rebels said, no, we need this paid now. So it's very precise actions that are being taken by the rebels in the Delta. The thing that strikes us, when we, the writers of the book and the work that we do at Platform, is one needs to emphasize the complicity of the oil companies in this process. It's often the case that we tend to dress up the way in which we look at Nigeria as being a chaotic state, a failed state in the southern part of Nigeria, and there's nothing to be done, and the poor oil companies are, you know, at the mercy of the winds there. But they are fundamentally actors in this process. They're fundamentally part of the problem. This year is a significant year. It's 50 years since oil was commercially discovered in Nigeria. Shell BP, in fact, struck oil commercially in 1956. It's 50 years this year. 50 years, $300 billion estimated worth of oil coming out of the Niger Delta, and as you say, people live in abject poverty. And the companies are complicit in that, not just the government of Nigeria and so on.
What do you think needs to happen now, and how organized is the resistance? And in the British press, I'm wondering if it is like the U.S. press in vilifying those that take a stand against. It's always militants, kidnappers, thugs. That's usually how vagabonds.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What needs to happen? Well, the first thing that needs to happen is that the corporations, the oil corporations, particularly Shell and then Chevron and Mobil and so on, need to be held accountable for what they've done, need to be held accountable for 50 years of environmental despoliation, human rights abuses that they've been implicated in. They need to be held accountable, and there needs to be a just process by which the revenue from the oil that's extracted from the Delta is distributed. But first and foremost, I think, is that the accountability of the companies and also the individuals within the companies. Let us think specifically about the individuals who've made these choices. To give a specific example, after the death of Ken Saro-Wiwa, which I'm sure your listeners will know about.
Ken Saro-Wiwa, who died just over 10 years ago, who
November.
Was a spokesperson for the Ogoni people, who were taking on Shell in the early 90s.
Yeah, sorry.
And executed in a military tribunal with other minority rights activists in Nigeria.
Just after that, Shell instituted a whole series of what some people call greenwash, what the company called social responsibility processes. And one of those was that there should be a series of letters whereby the heads of the oil company in Nigeria, for example, would write to the head of the exploration and production unit in The Hague in London and say that the company was abiding by the principles of the company, the basic principles, which was respect for human life, respect for the environment, etc., which was laid down at a set of new principles published in 1997. So every year, the head of Shell Nigeria had to write a letter saying, we're applying to those, we're abiding by them. And every year, the head of the Shell would say, good, we've received this letter, that's good. One of the interesting things about this new principle is that they had to accept personal responsibility for the accuracy of those letters. So how come the heads of Shell in Nigeria, who we can name as Sir Philip Watts, Basil Omimi, Chris Finlayson, how come they can have written those letters in the circumstances that we've seen over the last 10 years and get away with it? And it's appalling.
Do you have any hope as we wrap up right now?
Yes, I think there is hope if we can keep the momentum of public view on this. We need to get public understanding of the situation in Niger Delta. That's one of the reasons why we've been organizing a project called the Remember Saro-Wiwa Project, which is to create a living memorial for Ken Saro-Wiwa and all the people in the Delta who've been affected by oil production over the last 50 years in London. It's a sculpture and an education project to educate citizens here in London.
You've talked about Shell. There's also, of course, ExxonMobil and Chevron. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill and I went in 98 to Nigeria and produced the documentary Drilling and Killing Chevron and Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship. But in 10 seconds, the whole group of oil companies in the Niger Delta.
Yes. I mean, one needs to look at this as a web. One of the ways in which we understand this work is it's a carbon web. It's a web of all these companies working together and all the security agencies and the advertising agencies and so on and so forth. The whole lot needs to be looked at.
I want to thank you, James Marriott, co-author of The Next Gulf, London-Washington Oil Conflict in Nigeria. That does it for our week of broadcast from London. Go to our website, democracynow.org, for all information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Mike Berkshire for Docaduce, Elizabeth Press, Anna Nagara. I want a special thanks to Megan Whitney and Nick Masiello. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.